Hello, it's Wednesday the 18th of May and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. President Yoon Suk-yeol said the spirit of the May 18th pro-democracy movement serves as the cornerstone of national unity as he attended a ceremony to mark the event in Gwangju. We'll have more on this story in our news briefing shortly. Meanwhile, the Yoon administration has announced that South Korea will be taking part in a summit launching the US-led Indo-Pacific Economic Framework virtually next week. We discuss the implications of Korea's involvement in the initiative for our in-depth today. And then coming up on Korea Book Club, we look at another moving work by the author of the award-winning graphic novel, Grass. We have all that and more on today's Korea 24. Today marks a somber anniversary in the nation, the May 18th pro-democracy movement, also known as the Gwangju Uprising. Present in the annual commemoration was President Yoon Suk-yeol, who upheld its spirit as a cornerstone of national unity. For more on this and our other headlines of the day, we're joined on the line by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello.
Eunice, it was a particularly memorable and symbolic anniversary this year. Not only was the president present at the commemoration, but also his cabinet and many members of his party, the People Power Party, something that has not been seen from a conservative administration often. Can you give us a summary of the event today?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a show of political unity, local media have said, as about 100 People Power Party lawmakers, including the party leadership, made the trek to the southwestern city of Gwangju, a traditional stronghold of the Liberal Democratic Party. The president also notably walked through the quote-unquote door of democracy with bereaved family members, a symbolically significant move that is a first by a conservative president. Among the some 2,000 people who were in attendance at the 42nd anniversary ceremony were President Yoon's cabinet ministers, as you mentioned, as well as presidential aides, side by side with lawmakers and leaders of their main rival, the Democratic Party. At the end of the ceremony, everyone joined in on a protest tune dubbed Marching for the Beloved, hand in hand, breaking from previous conservative governments which had refrained from singing in unison.
President Yoon also addressed the crowd. What were some of the points that he made?
President Yoon said the nation remembers the sacrifices made in bloodshed to protect liberal democracy and the values of human rights during the pro-democracy uprising that had run from May 18th to the 27th in the year 1980, emphasizing that the spirit of the movement is the restoration of universal values itself, the very spirit of a democratic constitution. He said every person in the country should be able to enjoy the values of liberty and human rights. Ad-libbing, "We are Gwangju." The president also repeated the word freedom 12 times during his speech, in which he said the spirit of the May 18 pro-democracy movement served as a cornerstone of national unity. He also pledged to support the economic development of Gwangju City and the surrounding Jeolla region, referring to their roles in advancing the country's artificial intelligence and technology-based sectors.
Okay, later in the day, the Yoon government disclosed some agenda details on an upcoming visit by U.S. President Joe Biden. He is set to arrive on Friday, Eunice.
That's right. President Biden is set to arrive in South Korea Friday evening, and Saturday will begin with a visit to the Seoul National Cemetery, followed by a 90-minute summit with President Yoon, followed by a joint press conference and an official dinner. The first deputy director of the National Security Office, Kim Tae-yol, announced the schedule. He also noted, in reference to an earlier report by CNN, that an ICBM test could be timed for Biden's Korea visit, that ICBM launch does appear imminent, while the likelihood of a nuclear test over the weekend is relatively low. He indicated there are contingency plans should a major provocation occur during Biden's two-night, three-day trip here in South Korea.
Can we briefly touch on that CNN report before we move on? Can you give us a bit more details?
Sure. So CNN Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr had reported that North Korea appeared to be readying an ICBM test, quote unquote, within the next 48 to 96 hours, citing a U.S. official familiar with intelligence. Now, without elaborating, the official said conditions that were present in prior ICBM launches were being noticed now. CNN said the launch site under satellite observation was near Pyongyang.
Meanwhile, South Korea has confirmed its participation in the so-called Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or IPEF, viewed by many as being part of Washington's efforts to counter China's growing influence in the region. Can you tell us more?
Sure. The presidential office said President Yoon will be taking part virtually in this summit as the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework is set to be launched next Tuesday in Japan. The summit will be chaired by U.S. President Joe Biden, which reportedly will serve as the start of negotiations for a regional economic framework. Now, Yoon is said to be seriously considering expressing South Korea's active support for the IPEF, a matter which will likely be discussed when he meets with Biden in Seoul on Saturday. And China, obviously not very happy about this. It had earlier expressed displeasure over Seoul's plan to join the regional bloc. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said this week that Seoul and Beijing should oppose the negative impact of quote-unquote decoupling and maintain global supply chains in a stable manner.
Moving on to headlines concerning the domestic economy next, a state-run research institute has lowered its growth forecast for South Korea's economy for this year while significantly raising its inflation forecast. Can you give us more details?
Yeah, the Korea Development Institute, or KDI, on Wednesday projecting the domestic economy will expand 2.8% this year. That is a revision down from a previous prediction of 3%. Assessing that a mild recovery momentum will continue despite the effects of the pandemic and also the supply chain disruptions, KDI made the adjustment to reflect a lower than expected private spending in the first quarter and also rising raw material costs. The think tank also sharply raised its inflation outlook for the year from 1.7% last November to 4.2%, citing high energy and food prices amid the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war.
Checking in with North Korea's COVID-19 situation, some 233,000 more people have come down with fever, and that's according to state media, I understand.
Yes, and these figures, of course, should be taken with a grain of salt with North Korea under-resourced medical system in mind. KCNA, citing the state emergency quarantine headquarters, said around 233,000 new fever cases were reported throughout the country between 6 p.m. Monday and 6 p.m. Tuesday, and that there were six more people who had died, bringing the death toll to 62. KCNA referring to fever cases here in a reference to suspected COVID cases, as they do not have a testing apparatus underway as it appears. KCNA also carried a report on a meeting of the presidium of the political bureau of the party, essentially Kim Jong-un's top leadership, in which he reprimanded senior officials for failing to properly react to COVID-19 in these early stages, in which Kim said, quote unquote, time is life, criticizing officials for a worsening of complexity in a race against time. Kim urged every unit and worker to be aware of the gravity of the situation and stay alert against a lack of perception and preparations.
And finally, let's cap it off with an update of South Korea's COVID-19 snapshot, Eunice.
Sure. The KDCA said there were 31,352 new COVID cases registered throughout Tuesday, in the lowest Wednesday announced tally to be reported in 15 weeks, basically a continuation of a trend we've been seeing. There were also 35 overseas transmissions among them. The number of critically ill hospitalized patients was down by 20 from a day earlier to 313, and the number of deaths came to 31, or four more than the previous day.
Eunice, thank you for those updates today.
You bet.
During his first budget speech to Parliament on Monday, President Yoon Suk-yeol confirmed that he will be discussing the issue of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework with US President Joe Biden during their summit this Saturday. And then it was announced today that South Korea will indeed join the US-led initiative and that Yoon will virtually take part in a summit next week launching the framework. However, there are concerns that Seoul's moves could take a toll on its relationship with Beijing. To get some expert analysis on this issue, we're joined on the line by International Trade and Diplomacy Professor Lee Hyo-young of the Korean National Diplomatic Academy. Professor Lee, thank you for your time today.
Yes, I'm very glad to join you today.
So the US government has confirmed that the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or IPEF, will be launched during President Biden's upcoming trip to Asia, specifically during his visit to Japan, slated for Sunday to Tuesday after his stop in Korea. So first off, can you give us details about the IPEF? What is it exactly? What does it focus on and what does it aim to do?
Well, the IPEF is basically the establishment of an economic security network in key industrial areas among countries that can be trusted in the Asia-Pacific region. It is comprised of four main pillars, namely trade, supply chain, decarbonization, and anti-corruption. So basically, based on these, around these four areas, the U.S. is leading a cooperation initiative so that these cooperation initiatives can be strengthened. So the first pillar is on trade, which covers mainly digital economy and labor and environment. So it's basically thinking of creating new rules that may be binding. However, they will be unlike the CPTPP or RCEP, which is in the form of trade agreement. This is more in the form of an arrangement, according to the U.S. The second pillar is supply chain resiliency, which is very similar to what the U.S. Biden administration has been announcing its approach in the numerous supply chain reports and the trade policy agenda, which the USTR has announced previously. So basically, it will work on information sharing so that supply chain risk can be identified in advance. And it is also will also work to expand joint investments or developing joint technology standards or promoting cooperation in critical resources and minerals. And the third pillar and the fourth are on decarbonization and anti-corruption, which is basically areas which the Biden U.S. administration thinks it's very important for making new rules or cooperating in to form a new international economic order.
Right. You mentioned it's different from the Beijing-led Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, and the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. Can you explain a bit more for us? How does the IPEF differ from these other agreements? Is it just the fact that those are trade agreements and this framework is a bit more broader than that, but at the same time, perhaps it's a bit more vague as well?
The IPEF, as its name suggests, is not a trade agreement, but an economic framework. So I think that what the U.S. was aiming for is for coming up with an arrangement which is less binding. So basically, the most important difference between IPEF and RCEP and CPTPP is that Unlike RCEP and CPTPP, IPEF does not contain any market access commitments in the trade pillar. In other words, does not contain any concessions to eliminate tariffs on goods or services. And so it only contains commitments on new rules and perhaps cooperation initiatives, promises to strengthen cooperation in the areas which the IPEF covers. And there are rumors that this arrangement may take the form of an agreement, so-called executive agreement. This is similar to the U.S.-China agreement that took place under the Trump administration. And I believe that this is because the U.S. Biden administration has not been approved of the TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, which enables the administration to negotiate on and establish trade agreements without being involved by the U.S. Congress. So there is a structural problem involved here.
Mm.
But basically, the main difference is that it does not contain any market access commitments,
sure,
as RCEP and CPTPP.
And I guess another key point is the fact that it's U.S.-led, and it seems, mm-hmm, to be an aim for the U.S. to bolster its presence in the region. Do you, mm-hmm, think the framework will help do that?
Well, it could, but I think the more important point is that compared to the TPP or the CPTPP, which the U.S. is not present, although the CPTPP was launched under the leadership of Japan after the U.S. opted out, it is there and it leads the new rules-based system in the mainly among the Asia-Pacific region countries. But because the U.S. is not there, the impact as a new rules-based system seems to be smaller than expected. But since the IPEF is now led by the U.S. and the presence of U.S. will obviously be evident in the Asia-Pacific region due to the IPEF, I think that the new rules-based order that will be formed as an outcome will have more impact and more effectiveness. And it may actually work to replace the old order, economic order, which is becoming very increasingly irrelevant. And so the important point is here, I think, is that not that the U.S. presence will be strengthened, but rather that due to the U.S. participation, the new rules-based system in which the Asia-Pacific countries will also be participating in will have more impact and effectiveness. And I think that the significance is in there.
I understand Japan, Australia, Singapore and New Zealand were asked to join initially. Are there plans for this to be broader? How have, for example, ASEAN countries responded to this initiative?
Actually, just last week, President Biden had engaged with ASEAN countries to discuss their participation in IPEF in the U.S.-ASEAN summit meeting. And according to the reports, except for Singapore and the Philippines, the rest of the ASEAN countries, namely Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Brunei, and Vietnam, are reportedly rather reluctant to join. And I think that there are several reasons behind this.
Mm.
Basically, while the ASEAN countries very welcome the U.S.'s renewed stance on placing more importance on ASEAN countries than the previous U.S. administrations, they seem to be quite concerned about being involved more deeply and more directly in the U.S.-China rivalry, the geopolitical confrontation.
Right.
And more technically, as I already mentioned, it is highly likely that there will be no market access commitments in the trade pillar of the IPEF, which actually is a very important carrot for ASEAN countries to join any new trade agreement. And furthermore, the labor and environmental standards, which are expected to be an important part of the trade pillar of the IPEF, are very ambitious. And so they may serve as barriers to the developing countries of the ASEAN to joining the IPEF.
As we mentioned, the Yoon administration has expressed South Korea's interest in joining the initiative. And President Yoon said it will be discussed in his summit with Biden. What could the IPEF do for South Korea? How beneficial could it be?
Well, as I mentioned numerously during this interview, I think that the first pillar, the trade pillar of the IPEF, is expected to provide us with new rules for digital trade and the digital economy. As you know, particularly due to the pandemic, there has been a very strong growth in electronic commerce trade volumes. But currently, there are no rules, no multilateral rules that provide for any guidance or guideline on the liberalization of digital trade or disciplines on e-commerce. But the fact is that during the past two or three years, there has been quite an active development in the number of so-called digital trade agreements established mainly among countries in Asia. And they have been mainly led by countries like Singapore or Japan. But unfortunately, Korea has not been an active member in this effort. To be more frank, Korea has been practically left out of such a development in the digital trade rules. It is only a member of RCEP, which has very shallow commitments. And it also recently concluded a digital partnership agreement with Singapore. But these are only the two agreements on digital trade, which Korea has been joining. So Pillar 1 in IPEF is expected to sort of wrap up all these fragmented digital trade rules in the Asia-Pacific region. So it is quite a natural order for Korea to be part of this endeavor. Mm. And more importantly, it shouldn't lose this window of opportunity to becoming a rulemaker, as it did not in the case of TPP. And the second point is obviously more secure, more strong relations with trusted partner countries in making a supply chain more resilient. As you know, there have been a chain of events involving supply chain shocks, such as the blockade by Shanghai and many shocks due in the aftermath of the Russia-Ukraine war. Mm. And there are inflationary pressures due to the shortage of supply of critical resources and food, which all loom very dark for prospects for world economic growth. And so it is very important that we belong to this initiative to make our supply chain more resilient. And this is all the more important because it would provide the necessary predictability and stability for our businesses to do business with our partner countries. And currently, as you know, the current international economic order is in chaos. And so we need to quickly make new rules that are more relevant and reflect the changing needs such as digital and environment in the new rules. And I expect the IPEF rules would be able to provide this much-needed stability, at least for the Asia-Pacific countries.
Right. So there are reasons to want to be part of this initiative. Mm-hmm. However, as I hinted at the introduction, one key regional partner that might not be so keen on the idea is China. Mm-hmm. Trade tensions between the U.S. and China remain, and any attempt for the U.S. to strengthen ties in the region will likely not be received well in Beijing. And the fact that Yun is so openly expressing Korea's interest to join and court Biden could also potentially rub Beijing up the wrong way. How mm-hmm. do you think South Korea's potential entry into the IPEF could affect its relations with Beijing?
Mm-hmm. Well, the outcome of IPEF could lead to containing China further in the Asia-Pacific region, especially in the area of advanced technology, because it is considered to be a very important element for the U.S. Innovative technology foundation, and it may further strengthen its control, its management of export controls, and strengthen coordination among partner countries, its export control regime to sort of decouple China from the region. However, there are other areas that are not as strict or tight for China to comply with if China is willing to comply with the new rules and standards. But practically speaking, the new rules for involving labor and environment, I think, could be quite difficult for China to join. And another important point is that Korea has actually been very dependent on China as an export destination and also as an import destination. So both the U.S. market and China market are very important for Korea. Mm. In numbers, Korean exports to China as a proportion of the total exports is almost 30%, compared to 26% of Japan and 22% of ASEAN. I think it is very high. But it has been actually been decreasing after the U.S.-China rivalry. But I think the point is that even if we join the IPEF And we established new rules with our partner countries, including the U.S., and we strengthened our resiliency of the supply chain, and we strengthened our economic cooperation based on values. At the same time, I think we need to maintain our trade relations with China because this would be in line with our economic security approach because we need to be more practical in our trade relations. And that, I think, will be the policy that will be actually be based on national interests. So we need a very balanced and practical approach considering our trade relations with China, even though we joined the IPF.
Sure, that would be ideal. But do you think the IPEF, do you think that framework could further deepen the U.S.-China rivalry at the moment that has caused so many concerns around the world?
I think that would depend on how China reacts. For example, in the worst-case scenario, China could react by imposing export controls on food and agricultural supplies or even critical minerals and resources. This would actually have a devastating effect, considering the current shortage of supplies due to the pandemic and other additional supply chain shocks due to the Russia-Ukraine war. So therefore, I believe, or rather, I hope that China will be more cautious before taking any retaliatory actions, because China would also prefer to have an open and inclusive and predictable, stable trading environment in the Indo-Pacific region. And furthermore, unlike the Trump administration, the Biden administration seems to be taking on a more contained approach to the U.S.-China rivalry, which is more based on rulemaking and cooperative policies with its partner countries. So I believe that there is some room, although very small room, for cooperation with China if China is actually willing to negotiate and change its current practices into a direction that is more in compliance with the new rules that are in the process of development.
Well, this is one of the many topics that we will need to look out for from the Yun-Biden summit on Saturday. For now, we'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Professor Yi Hyo-young of the Korean National Diplomatic Academy. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you for your time.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update.
The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 5.54 points, or 0.21% on Wednesday, closing the day at 2,625.98. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 5.59 points, or 0.65%, to close at 871.57. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 8.41 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,266.61.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, a daily segment looking at some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. And for that, we have Walter Lee joining us in the studio. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jung. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what stories have you brought for us today?
Okay, so first we'll discuss what Dallas police have discovered about the suspect of last week's Koreatown hair salon shooting. Then we'll talk about how some meal kits in South Korea have been found with beyond permissible daily sodium intake levels. And finally, we'll find out which young South Korean actress is being questioned by police for driving under the influence.
Okay, so we start with a development concerning one of the latest attacks against the Asian community in America. We're talking about the shooting in Dallas. The suspect has been caught, and it does seem like it was racially motivated then, Walter.
Yes, that's right. So police in the U.S. state of Texas say a man suspected of opening fire and wounding three Korean women in a hair salon in Dallas last week was delusional about Asians. According to media reports, Dallas police booked the 36-year-old suspect Jeremy Smith on Tuesday and charged him with three counts of assault with a deadly weapon. He's being held on a $300,000 bond. The police chief, Eddie Garcia, said the suspect harbored delusions about Asians since experiencing a car crash involving an Asian man 2 years ago.
Before we talk about that last detail, can you tell us a bit more about the shooting incident itself and what happened?
Well, according to the police, Smith, who is African-American, fired 13 shots with a 22 caliber rifle into the Hair World Salon in Koreatown on Wednesday of last week. Fortunately, the three women who were shot, each in their arm, leg, and back, reportedly sustained non-life-threatening injuries. The police said this shooting may also be linked to two previous drive-by shootings at Asian American businesses in the city, adding that they are still investigating whether Smith was involved. Police are having such suspicions as the description of the suspect's vehicle was similar in all three shootings.
So it seems he was targeting Asians, but do the police believe the latest shooting incident was related purely to racially motivated intentions, or are they arguing it was more to do with his mental health, perhaps?
So that's a good question. So Garcia said it's too early to tell, only saying he regards it as a hate crime. The FBI on Tuesday opened a federal hate crime investigation on the latest shooting, along with federal prosecutors in Texas and the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. Garcia declined to comment on whether Smith has been diagnosed with a mental illness, but according to the Associated Press, the suspect's girlfriend told investigators that Smith had been admitted to several mental health facilities because of the delusions about Asians wanting to hurt him.
Well, thankfully he has been caught, and thankfully no one suffered any life-threatening injuries.
Yes.
But it is disturbing to see the number of hate crimes against the Asian community in America piling up like this. OK, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
So, yes, if you're an avid fan of meal kits, which you can prepare home-cooked meals in several minutes, our next story could be somewhat alarming. The nation's leading consumer organization, Consumers Korea, said Tuesday that it inspected 25 meal kit products and found that 11 of them had exceeded the maximum level of daily sodium intake. The World Health Organization recommends that a person should consume less than 2 grams of sodium per day in a bid to prevent cardiovascular diseases, which are the leading causes of death around the world. The group also found that 6 of the inspected products had higher levels of saturated fat than the recommended daily intake level.
Right, I think people might have suspected that the meals were not particularly healthy,
right,
but it is disconcerting to see those numbers, especially as meal kits have become so popular in Korea, particularly since the COVID-19 pandemic broke out as well.
Yeah, that's right. So more and more people came to prepare meals with such kits during the pandemic as they refrained from going out to eat. The surge in both single-person households and families where both parents work also led to the strong popularity of such meal products. Take note that the size of the nation's meal kit market sharply rose in value to more than 188 billion won, or around $148 million in 2020, compared to 10 billion won in 2017, which is around $8 million. The market is expected to expand further to the amount of around 725 billion won by 2025. That's around $570 million.
So it is a rapidly growing market. I understand the consumer organization found some other concerning findings in their inspection as well.
Yes, so it also found that of the 25 meal kit products, 19 had failed to label their nutritional contents. The consumer group has stressed the need for meal kits to be subject to food products that are required to include nutrition labeling. Meanwhile, the organization called on consumers who often purchase meal kits to reduce the amount of sauce that is included, or to add vegetables such as green onion or onion to make the dishes less salty, thus lessening the level of sodium intake.
Yes, and particularly labeling, I think, is so important because there's a difference between not knowing what's in the meal versus knowing what's in it, but then deciding to eat it anyway.
Right.
Okay, let's move on to our final story. What do you have for us?
Yes, so South Korean actress Kim Se-ryeon was questioned by police after she was caught drunk driving in Seoul's Gangnam district on Wednesday morning. The Gangnam police station booked Kim on charges of violating Road Traffic Act. The 21-year-old actress is accused of driving under the influence at around 8 a.m. near Cheongdam-dong, and police were dispatched after receiving several reports from citizens of a vehicle swerving on the road.
So it seems that she couldn't even drive straight.
Right.
Was anybody hurt?
Thankfully, no one was hurt, and this is including Kim herself. Turns out, however, that the actress's car took a hit after she rammed it into a nearby streetlight and guardrail. Kim tested positive on a breathalyzer test, but when police sought to determine her alcohol level, the young actress refused and expressed intent to get a blood test instead.
Has there been any response from the actress's side on the latest incident?
Her management agency, Gold Medalist, confirmed that the actress received a blood test for more accurate results with regard to the DUI allegations. The agency said the test results are set to come out after 2 weeks, adding that Kim will actively cooperate with police should they summon her again. Now, Kim first started appearing in magazines as a toddler and debuted as an actor in 2009 with the movie A Brand New Life. She rose to stardom when she starred alongside top actor Won Bin in the 2010 film The Man From Nowhere. And currently, she's taking part in filming of a Netflix original series.
Okay, well, we'll see what those test results show and what happens to her appearance in this Netflix series as well. In the meantime, that's where we wrap it up for today's Career Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Walter, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.
We continue on now to Korea Book Club, our weekly dive into the world of Korean literature through works available in translation and beyond. Joining me in the studio once again for that is literary critic Barry Welsh, ready to introduce another work for us. Barry, hello. It's good to see you.
Yes, it's great to see you too, Jang-ho.
Okay, so what do you have for us this week, Barry?
So today we're talking about a graphic novel called The Waiting. The Korean title is Kidarim, and it's by Geum-suk Gendry Kim, and it's translated by Janet Hong. And the English translation was published by Drawn and Quarterly, the Canadian publishing company, and it was just published last year in 2021. And the Korean original version was actually only published in 2020, so it's a very new book. Regular listeners will know that Gendry Kim is a very highly regarded and successful manhwa artist here in Korea. Her graphic novels include The Song of My Father and Grass, as well as many more. And the translation of Grass won, you know, several of the, you know, the big comic book and illustrated book awards, including the prestigious Harvey Award. And when we reviewed it back in 2019, we said it was really a fantastic piece of work. And, you know, she's rightly celebrated here at home. She's won, you know, awards for her manhwa works here, especially one for Sister Mija. And her work is also very popular in Europe, where she's had several exhibitions of her books and illustrations. And often in her work, she says she focuses on people who are sort of outcast from society or marginalized by mainstream society. And like Grass, the last book that we reviewed, today's book, The Waiting, it's a graphic memoir about a woman who's been affected by war. And like Grass, it's another really quite remarkable achievement.
Yes, we've talked about Grass several times on the show before because of how well it's been received all over the world.
Right, yeah.
It was an incredibly moving portrait of a victim of Japanese wartime sexual slavery, inspired by real events, of course. You said this latest story is also about a woman affected by war. What story is Gendry Kim telling this time?
Right, so a couple of weeks ago we reviewed a short story called Losing a Sister by Lee Kyung-ja, and that was about two sisters separated by the Korean War who longed to be reunited at one of the, you know, the family reunions that have sporadically taken place over the past few decades. And The Waiting is based on this issue as well, and it's inspired by Gendry Kim's own family history. As a young adult, or a young-ish adult, working in France, she'd been living and working in France, she's shocked to learn that her now elderly mother has family members that she was separated from still living in North Korea. She has a first husband, she has a son, and she has siblings from whom she was separated during the Korean War. And then one day her mother hears from a neighbour that there might be a chance for another family reunion, like there's a plan that this might happen again. And as such, she's desperate to apply in the hope of meeting these long-lost relatives, in particular her son, whom she was separated for when he was very young and who she's continued to yearn for some news of over the many decades that have passed. And so Gendry Kim uses this revelation, you know, this sort of surprising, shocking revelation to delve into her mother's life story and her experiences before, during and after the Korean War.
Yes, so when we reviewed Losing a Sister, we said this was a familiar story that's well known here in Korea. Hundreds of thousands of families were separated during the Korean War. There have been state-organized family reunion events over the years, as you mentioned, 21 so far, I believe. But they've only been for a handful of families. Most of those separated haven't had any contact with their separated relatives, and most do not even know if they are alive. So with all that in mind, then, can you tell us a bit more about the story of this mother then? What actually led to her losing her husband and son?
Right, so the story starts in the present. So it starts in 2020 with Gendrikin is helping look after her ageing mother, whose health is increasingly failing. And when she learns about these missing family members, the story goes back. It flashes back in time to her mother's childhood in South Hamgyong province, which is in an area in North Korea. And it's in 1937 when her mother is a child. And from there, we see her very generally mostly happy childhood. And then she grows up through adolescence. She gets married to a man from a neighboring village. And they start a family together, and they're essentially very happy and mostly unaware of any, wider political issues that are happening. And then one day, some evacuees pass their home and ask for shelter. And it's then that they learn that the war has broken out. And they join the refugees that are sort of heading south. And it's during this sort of difficult, journey that her mother is separated from her husband and son. And of course, when the war ends, she's in the south and her husband is in the north. And Gendrikin uses the structure of this sort of present day with her mother as an older woman, and then the flashbacks to the past to reflect on, lots of different things. So the nature of trauma, of memory, of loss, and just the sort of the accumulated pain of passing time.
Yes. So, Barry, there are many books and films about families separated by the Korean War. It is a historic trauma that has been much explored, but perhaps not as a graphic novel. What does that bring to this topic? How does Gendry Kim explore this issue in her own way?
Right, so one of the quotes on the book cover is from another writer, from Alexander Chi, and Chi asks, how can black and white drawings do this? So, all of the drawings in this book, they're in, these sort of beautiful black and white ink drawings. And if we compare, The Waiting to stories like Losing a Sister and other, novels that we've talked about in the past, there is quite a significant difference. So, the writer of Losing a Sister, Lee Kyung-ja, a talented writer, and Losing a Sister is a moving story, and other stories like that are, moving and touching. But there's an extra dimension. There is something different about Gendry Kim's work, right? So there's something sort of uniquely, powerful and engaging and even unsettling about these just very, simple, sometimes stark, sometimes beautiful, but, always evocative black and white drawings in The Waiting. You can really see the weariness, of her old mother. You can feel the weight of time in these images. There's something about the way those images can sort of depict time, depict memory and how these things blend together that's different from how that works in a novel or, a documentary or a movie. I think it engages with your brain in a different way. And reading this, I was often struck by just how, beautiful the images are, even when they're depicting something, that's sort of challenging or difficult. They capture the fragility of human lives. This sort of fragile nature is what I think comes through the most. And, there's a bunch of other things that are touched on in this story as well, just the stress of looking after aging family members, the sadness of old age, and the nature of family relationships. And I think lots of those themes, will resonate with readers. And it really is a remarkable piece of work. And I highly recommend it, like we did with her previous book.
Yes, indeed. It sounds like Gendry Kim has not disappointed once again. We talked about the accolades that Grass received. It sounds like this will be another work that moves a lot of people and perhaps cement her status as a fantastic storyteller here in Korea. Once again, it's called The Waiting by Kum Suk Gendry Kim and translated by Janet Hong. That's all for this week's Korea Book Club. Barry, thank you for your review, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Okay, take care.
My name is Yu Taepyeong Yang. I'm a pansori singer and a member of the National Changguk Company of Korea. And you are now listening to Korea 24.
We finish up the show, as usual, with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. For that, our staff editor, Richard Larkin, joins us in the studio. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you, too.
Okay, so where are you taking us first?
So first, we will look at the Life and Style section of the Korea Herald. An article by Park Ga-young explains how Bunhwangsa, a Korean Buddhist temple, will open in Bodh Gaya, India, this week. The opening ceremony takes place on Saturday, and a delegation of 150 Korean Buddhists from South Korea's largest Buddhist sect, the Joge Order, will attend.
Okay, so that's interesting. Buddhism, which came from India, reached all the way to South Korea, now it's going back to India, it seems then. So where did this idea behind the opening of the temple start?
Well, according to the article, the project to build a Korean-style temple in Bodh Gaya was launched in 2019, when two female Buddhists, Salme and Yongchi, donated 5 billion won, or $3.9 million, to the cause. This was followed by more donations from other temples in South Korea, including Tongdosa, one of the three largest Buddhist temples in the country, totaling 3 billion won, which is around $2.3 million. The location was not chosen at random, as Bodh Gaya in northeastern India's Bihar state is one of Buddhism's four holiest sites. According to Buddhist texts, it is where Sakyamuni Buddha reached enlightenment under the Bodhi tree.
Okay, so what will the temple be used for?
So Bunhwangsa will serve as a refuge for Korean Buddhists and those seeking a spiritual awakening while on their pilgrimage. An official from the Joge Order said it has been a long-cherished dream of Korean Buddhists to establish one in Bodh Gaya. The article also mentions that the temple will also be part of the Order's 1 Million Vows Assembly initiative, which aims to boost its dwindling congregation amid decreases in both the general and Buddhist population in South Korea. The delegation of 150 Buddhist monks and practitioners will attend the ceremony this week and will be the largest group from Korea to complete a pilgrimage in India since the outbreak of COVID-19.
Okay, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us next?
So in the People section of the Korea Times, an article by Kang Sung-woo explains how the Republic of Korea Air Force's aerobatic team, also known as the Black Eagles, will be performing in Europe for the first time in 10 years. The team is comprised of 12 pilots who will fly 8 black, white and gold-coloured supersonic advanced trainer jets.
Do you know what, Richard? I actually saw the Black Eagles team when they were last in Europe.
Oh, really?
In the UK 10 years ago. Yes, they put on a fantastic show. It was pretty amazing. So what countries will they be visiting this time?
So the tour will start with 3 different international air shows in the UK through the whole month of July. First is the Southport Air Show on the 9th and 10th, the Royal International Air Tattoo on the 15th to 17th, and finally the Farnborough Air Show on the 19th to 22nd. Then they will also visit 13 other countries around the world, including Poland, Slovakia, Egypt and the Philippines. The idea behind the tour is to promote Korean-made aircraft and to show off military assets, including the FA-50 combat aircraft, which they export to a number of countries.
Yes, as you said, this will be the first time they're going to Europe in 10 years, so this is going to be quite a big occasion for them.
It is. This is the first time that all of the current members will perform overseas, as pilots usually stay with the team for 4 years. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the team was not able to take part in any international air shows during that period. According to one of the pilots, Yang Eun-ho, his dream of joining Black Eagles has come true, and he believes that the pilots around the world will watch the team's flights and evaluate the skills of Korean fighter pilots. Yang is also aiming at raising the status of South Korea by showing outstanding aerobatic performances.
Yes, if people can get a chance to see them, I definitely recommend it. They were the highlight of that air show when I went. So yes, definitely check them out if you can. Okay, that's where we'll wrap it up for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Richard, and we will see you next time.
Thank you.
And we wrap up our show there for today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. So do join us again then to continue to get your daily dose of Korean news analysis. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye. Thank you.